So my next guest is a director of automotive lifestyle business development for Hagerty Brand. He's an expert and resident classic car enthusiast and also provides written, video and live interviews. He has been playing with classic cars since he was in his nappies, diapers to you Americans. He can talk about barn finds, buying classic cars and restoring them till the cows come home. Please welcome Brad Phillips to the podcast. Brad, how are you and where are you, mate?
Hey, I'm doing great. I am sitting here in the great state of Maryland in the United States, and I'm so happy to be here talking to you and your audience. It's fantastic.
Yeah, welcome. Welcome to the show. Welcome. I think we're going to have the next 45 minutes or so. It's going to be interesting picking your brains about what was your first car, what was your favorite classic restoration. I'm going to go into a lot of that sort of stuff. So how did you get into cars? Because what I noticed that on your videos, you look like a mechanic. Are you a mechanic?
That's kind. I feel like I look more like a sweaty middle-aged guy cursing himself because he doesn't have a lift in his own garage. I was fortunate. I grew up in kind of a car family, which is the way a lot of this starts for people. They just get used to seeing, you know, grandpa's 1950 Dodge collecting dust over in the corner his whole life, and you start to get an interest in it that way. My father's a car guy, and ever since I've been able to buy cars myself, I've just loved all kinds of them. It's been a lot of fun.
What was your first car?
My first car as a bright-eyed 16-year-old in 1986 was a 1965 Mustang 2+2 Fastback. Okay. And I had loved those cars. Early Mustangs are one of those things. They make the parts for them everywhere. They're so much fun. And I was very lucky to do that as my first restoration project with my dad. It was awesome.
Oh, so that was a restoration project that you bought then? It wasn't?
Well, interestingly, back in the 80s, 65 Mustangs, they weren't really that old, right? I mean, it was, you know, barely 25 years old at the time, or barely 20 years old. Mm-hmm. And it was it was a forest green, and it had a kind of an ivy interior in it. And nowadays, honestly, I probably would have left it alone. But back in the 80s, we got to paint that Rangoon red. We got to put a different interior in it and put some fancy Magnum 500 wheels on it that were completely incorrect.
But it
was a great car and I was very fortunate as a high schooler to have it. It was a cool thing to learn on about all the hobby.
Yeah. So originality is your thing, or do you like aftermarket bits on a car? What's your thought?
So that's an interesting line of questioning, because the answer, of course, which you will hate, is it depends. Right?
If a
car is, when you get it, is basically original, numbers matching, and it's been preserved all through time, more or less before you get it, I do think there's a historical responsibility to preserve it in some way for future generations, right?
I
have a great illustration of this that's going on right now in my own garage. I've got a 66 Sunbeam Tiger. Awesome car. Love Tigers. I've always been into them for, you know, the past 20 years. This is the second one I've owned. And when it came to me, it had been repainted red from the original white at some point in the 70s, because somebody whacked it into something and it seemed to be a good time to go ahead and paint it while you're pulling the front end out.
Yeah.
It was still its original engine, original carburetor, original everything, original seats. Mm-hmm. So right now I took it all apart and I painted it white again and put a high performance 289 in it for fun. But I shrink wrapped the original motor and tucked it off to the side. So I can always say that the car still has its original bits sort of adjacent to it. And to put a bigger engine in it of a small block Ford variety, you don't change a bolt, you don't cut anything.
There's nothing. There's just bolt, and that's it, done.
Yep, that's it. A 260 to a 302, the external dimensions are identical. So I get a little more Wheaties out of it, a little more fun. But I haven't really hurt anything. And I don't mind that at all. And there's a lot of different ways you can go about cars, but that my personal philosophy is kind of do no harm, you know?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And what engine, did they come with American engines and Sunbeams?
Yeah, the Sunbeam Tiger did. So the Sunbeam Alpine they made for years, I think maybe the late 50s all the way through 67.
Yeah.
You could get a four-cylinder, a 1700cc engine. And they were really great alternative to like, you know, an MGB and that kind of thing. But for the American market, they made a few thousand of these that they shoehorned small block Fords in with four speeds. And Carroll Shelby's shop had a little to do with the prototyping of that, working with the Roots Group folks in Girard in England. And they made a Kraken car for less money than an XKE, which was tough because the XKE was already, you know, fairly inexpensive for the performance you got. So anyway, really, really cool car.
Yeah. You're the second person I've actually had on my podcast that's restoring a Sunbeam. Do you know Tony Fleming of Fleming's Autos?
I don't
Fleming's
personally.
Ultimate Garage down in, where is he? He's near Washington.
I don't, but I will bet that somewhere along the way, we're in one of the same Sunbeam clubs and we've probably met. But I can't say he's a personal friend, really? But now I'm inspired to go meet him.
Yeah, he's a really cool guy. And he's four quarters, got so many different lovely classic cars. I had him on my podcast and I think he's either restored one or he's restoring one now, I'm sure. Tony Fleming, his name is. But okay, what do you own at the moment then? What do you actually own?
Well, I got some weird cars.
Go on then.
I've only got four right now that I've just trimmed one down. So I've got the Tiger. I've got the 66 Tiger. I have a 1987 911 Carrera, and that's a really great year for Porsche 911s. It's the it's a G body. It's a G50 transmission car, and this is a absolutely bone stock original, kind of an 80s timepiece. It's guards red with black. It's just what you think of, and you're like, oh, well, that's a 911. You know, I've had a lot of Porsches, and this is great. I really enjoy the car. I road trip it all the time. My wife loves to drive it too. So that's a really good, ever reliable car in the garage. Okay. The other ones are a little odd. I've got a 1992 Toyota Century. That's a right-hand drive Japanese limousine that they never imported to the States. Matter of fact, I think the only places you ever see them are like New Zealand and Japan. I mean, they're really weird and rare. And unfortunately, it's one of these things that if something breaks and you call Toyota, they're like, well, we don't support that car anymore. Thanks for calling.
Really? So where'd you get all the parts from?
You don't. You hope that I needed some bits and pieces a few years ago, and I think I harvested from the only wrecked Toyota Century in the United States. So I bought everything I could get off it. Window motors, the little door computers and ECUs and things. But it's weird because it's got stuff like computer controlled shock absorbers, right? That you press the little button on the dash, and now it's like, okay, well, everything does that. Well, in 1992, that was really interesting and cool. Well, they're $2,500 a piece if you can find one.
Yeah.
So you learn how to work around the issue and put in standard air shocks to maybe replace the computer controlled stuff. But so that's a tough one.
That's a nice car. And I think my cousins are in Cyprus. We're from North Cyprus, Turkish Cypriots. And every now and again, I get pictures of abandoned cars in fields in Cyprus. Now, Muslims and I'm not a practicing Muslim. My family are Muslim. They don't chuck anything away. They don't like to chuck anything away. And they don't like buying anything secondhand, right? So you buy a car in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and the new model comes out, and you leave that one in the yard in the front of the house, right? So when I went to Cyprus a couple of years ago to see my aunties, whose Volkswagen Beetle is that? Whose Toyota Corolla is that? Whose Porsche There was a Porsche 928 in a field, just sitting there. I was like, we don't know. No one's come back for it for 20 years. I'm like, well, can we buy it and ship it to the UK? Yeah, that might be a bit difficult because the deeds, the whole, the paperwork's a little bit difficult. But I'm looking at trying to get a whole, well, I might not do it now because I've just published where all the cars are. But there in South Africa, really good you can find a lot of good cars down those countries. And because they're not a rainy, well, Cyprus is not very wet country, you get a lot of rust-free cars, which is great because, you know, then if you can buy them and ship them across, I mean, I've got space downstairs. I'm more than happy to put two or three cars down there and just stack them up and start restoring them. But, yes, it's interesting because I think there is a Toyota, one of those Toyotas in Cyprus. I'm sure there is. I'll get my cousin to send me a picture. If he's got a picture of it, I'll send it to you.
I love it. Thank you. Any help is appreciated. Yeah. Absolutely.
It's weird because you and I noticed you know Wayne Carini of the, is it the F40 classic car restoration shop?
Yeah, F40 Motorsports is his business entity for sure.
Yeah. He's a nice guy. I spoke to him a few years ago, very briefly on the phone. But other than that, I haven't really had much contact with him. I'd love to have him on my podcast as well. He'd be a great guest as well. Because he's another one that finds these barn finds. He just somehow he finds them and he purchases them and then restores them. And I'm like, I've been looking for a barn find in the UK for about 5 years and I've never found one.
Well, you know, we've got a series called Barn Find Hunter that we've had Tom Cotter out running around the United States for the last probably 4 or 5 years. And he did an episode in the UK also. So I got to tell you, there's stuff out there.
There is stuff out here. I mean, a few years ago, I noticed there was a guy in a place called Greenwich, southeast London, who had a Jaguar S-Type. Is it an S-Type? Not S-Type. The one after the E-Type. Which one was that?
Yeah, well, you had the XJS. That was the 12-cylinder.
The one before that. It was before the one, the XJS. Anyway, he had an old Jaguar on his front court and front drive. And I kept saying to my wife, I really want to go and knock on the door and see if he wants to sell it. It was rusting to pieces. And eventually, I just stopped at the side of the road, ran and knocked on the door. This posh English gentleman came to the door and I said, look, I'm a classic car restorer. Would you like to sell the Jack? He's like, no, it's my father's car and he passed away and we want to keep it. And over the last, I don't know, maybe 5-6 years now, I drive past that house. The car's still there, but it's like a plant pot now. It looks like something's growing out of the middle of it. It's so sad, you know. But what can you do? You can't force people to part with their items, you know. What was your car first restoration then? What was your first?
The first car I ever bought that was not also supposed to be my daily transportation, probably in the 1990s, was a 1968 Porsche 911. And when I bought it, well, okay, think at the time, they were $7,000, right? Like the market's changed a lot on the early 911 market and even 912s for sure. Yeah. I mean, they're all a fortune now. So when I bought this car, it had been seized in a United States Drug Enforcement Agency activity.
Yeah.
It had lived on the streets of Astoria, New York, which is not exactly Manhattan. This was at the time a very gritty area where this car had been brought in, and it was the wrong color. Everything had been kind of modified, had the wrong roof. Someone had hacked off a sunroof roof from a different coupe and welded it on. So it had not had an easy life by any stretch. But it ran. It still had its original engine, and I thought it was super cool. So I literally spent 10 years making that car into an absolute beautiful hot rod. Building the engine up to like 2.2S specs, really nice, made it silver, had a red original 1968 interior that I found to put in the car. It was sharp by the time I was done with it. And like many cars, I had the foresight to sell it for now what is probably $100,000 less than what it's worth today. So, you know, you just keep moving.
Because that was one of my questions to you. Because can you make money from restoring cars? And if so, what's the key points to look out for?
You know, in my experience, it really boils down to a couple of things. You've got to either buy it really cheap, which is harder these days with the internet. I think more people are aware of what things are worth than what they used to be. There's no secrets. You're not circling ads in a newspaper anymore, hoping to find something. You know, it's on Craigslist. There's 8,000 people. And like, you know, we have this, our valuation guide. So we're out there helping people understand what things are worth, right? Through the Hagerty valuation tools. So that's one thing. You've got to buy it really cheap, I think. And you've got to negotiate that, but it's hard. The other thing, and the only way that I've really kind of try and keep ahead of it is the labor. I'm not someone who can afford to send cars to a professional, you know, ultra incredible restoration shop all the time. There are people that do it and they know that it's going to be perfect. And when it comes back, okay, it doesn't matter what it's worth. You're probably upside down almost immediately on most cars once you have that full kit type thing done to it. So I like to do a lot of the work myself. And I think that helps me with the fact that, yeah, I may be buying a lot of parts, but at least screwing them together, that's something I am dealing with. And that's part of my fun and how I think I have skin in the game, you know, in the hobby.
Yeah, I mean, I did a classic car restoration course a couple of years ago. I don't know whether the States have courses in college that you can go and learn how to restore classic cars. There's only two places or three places in the UK you can do that. One of them's a Jaguar specialist who's a working workshop, and you pay, I think, £1,500 sterling for the week, and you stay in there. Like, they've got dorms upstairs that you can stay there and you don't go anywhere. And then there's Stevenage College, which is across the road from where I work, actually. So it was nice and easy for me. So I went there. I learned how to weld. I learned how to cut metal, shape metal, English wheel, or the what do you guys call the English wheel? Because apparently we're not supposed to say English anymore.
That still works. We call it English wheeling. Absolutely.
No. The PC people will come down on me on that. It's So I learned a lot of that. I'm not an expert on restoring cars. But what I notice is I don't enjoy the welding, the grinding of the metal, the cutting of the metal, the cutting of the rust out of the car. What I enjoy doing is stripping a car down, bagging and tagging it, and then sending it off to be rust-proofed, welded, blah, blah, painted, comes back to me, and then I stand there and figure out how to build it back up. And that's what I enjoy. So that's what I'm going to do with the Mini as well. I think I'm going to just send off the body to be repaired. There has been some talk of having a reshelled body on it. So I think English Heritage make the shells out of the original molds from Mini. But I think once you start doing that, correct me if I'm wrong, I think this is the way I think. If you was to scrap that shell, you're kind of getting rid of the skin of the car. You know, it's a major part of the car. And so you're losing that historical feeling. Do you not think?
Absolutely. And there are companies in the States that, you know, for instance, if you want to go build your own 1965 Mustang Fastback, you can go to a company called Dynacorn, who makes a complete, perfect, original sort of tooling of an original Mustang body that you can just buy, and then you can assemble yourself like a big model kit. Mm-hmm. Now, the regulations on taking an old VIN number and attaching it to that new chassis are pretty strict. There are a lot of places that's a huge no-no, and you cannot do that. I always like to think that you take whatever is left, keep the biggest piece of that original car and work from there. But it's not always possible. But truly, that's what's great about this hobby. If you want to make your own vehicle like this, great. Why not? Go for it. I mean, you wouldn't do that to a Bugatti. I mean, you'd go to Persang, right? And you'd buy one of their perfect replicas that doesn't eliminate anything original from any of the originals that are out there. Yeah. I don't mind your thought. I mean, they made a lot of minis, so I don't think there's any harm in that specifically. But I don't know, unless it's a total basket case, I'd say, yeah, fix that thing up. Keep it original.
No, it's not. It's not. The only problem I've got is the side seals. The roof has got a little hole in it. It could probably be patched up pretty easily. And then the front end really needs to come off, and the whole subframes need to be dropped out, I think, and either restored or replaced. I don't know yet, but it's not a bad car. It's been in the garage now for some years as well, so it's in dry conditions. But what I was thinking of doing with that was restore it back to the original, because I'm an original geek. I like stuff that originally came from the factory. And then possibly making it in such a way that it's comfortable for my wife to sit in it, because she says she won't drive that car anymore. She now drives the new Mini. and she's like, I'm never going back to that old Mini. And at one time, that was our only car. And I remember going to an interview in Devon or Cornwall, which is about 150, 200 miles, which is nothing to you guys, but it's a lot for us. It's down south coast. And it was during the mad cow season, this disease that was going around. So any car coming into this town had to go through like an antibacterial pool. But you know, the Minis, they're quite low, aren't they?
Yeah.
So we started to go through it, and the antibacterial liquid started to come into the car. I said to us, stop, rewind. Let's reverse. We went another way in the end. But yeah, definitely this year I'm going to video that. I'm going to video that and put that up on my YouTube channel, I think, because that would be a good basic starting point for me to start restoring that car. So barn finds, how do you find them, and what's the what have you bought from a barn? What have you restored from a barn?
Well, let me tell you, I have not had a lot of personal luck on barn finds per se, I would say, in a long time. I'd say my closest, I bought a 1965 Porsche 912 some years ago. Mm-hmm. That had been in the woods since the 1980s, and it was utterly destroyed. But it was really hilarious because I'm out visiting a client. This is out in rural Tennessee at the time in the United States. And I owned a 1968 911 at that time, a different one than the previous one.
Yeah.
And I see this thing poking out through the trees. And I said, what is that down there? They said, thing's been sitting out there. We pushed it back there when the engine blew a long time ago, and then a tree fell on it in the tornado. We haven't touched it. I'm like, can I have it? Can I do something with it? And I really love the fact that I went back for it the next day with a trailer, and he had bush hogged, which was what Americans call it when you go in and you clear a bunch of bushes and trees and grass away from something in a in this kind of an area. He did that with a tractor and then wrapped a chain around the front end of it and dragged it out of the woods for me. And there it was. And it was basically complete. So we hauled it up. We winched it on this trailer and I took it back. And unfortunately, there was nothing savable about it. It had been, the metal that was left was just paper thin. It was really held together more by moss than anything. But it did have the original date-coded wheels, gauges, seats. I mean, there were thousands of dollars worth of usable, really early Porsche parts still on this thing, even though it had been smashed and left for dead. Mm. So I spent 6 months. I built a wooden platform for it, cleaned it all up, and soaked everything in oil and everything so I could unloosen all these bolts. And I helped get parts from that car to Porsche projects all over the world, England, Australia. I think stuff went to the Middle East, if I remember. So, I mean, really everywhere out there, there are cars that exist and are running and pretty original or more original because of this thing. So I think even though a car couldn't be driven, I think there's still a value in keeping your eye open for things that might help another car hobbyist, you know?
Yeah. Talking about rusty bolts, how do you get those off? Because I've had a nightmare getting some of those bits off that Mini.
You know, we have a product called Croil here in the States.
Okay.
And there's also stuff called Liquid Wrench that's been out a long time.
Okay.
But a lot of old timers will just say diesel fuel works as good as anything.
Yeah.
If you soak something just in pure diesel, and you know, YouTube is fantastic. I've also, you know, heat helps a ton too, that kind of thing. But what I've learned is if you torque a bolt, if you soak it, and then you give it a little bit of just a smidge of a tighten before you try to go backwards, that seems to help break that bond of rust apart a little bit.
So tighten it first and then come back on yourself.
A little bit. It just gives it a little bit of a squish in there, I guess, to break that bond. But of course, some of these bolts, I mean, especially if you're trying to take something off on an exhaust manifold or something that's been heat cycled 8 bajillion times. I mean, it's like, good luck. I mean, who knows what's going to happen? It could snap right off no matter what you soak it in. It's a little bit of a crapshoot.
Have you showed any cars at the Concours of Elegance or Concours America or anything like that? Have you showed any
I am really known more for driving stuff and getting it dirty than I am taking to a car show and sitting.
Yeah.
And for someone who's my business has been helping support a lot of that with Concours and helping people get, you know, enjoy the love of the hobby in that way. I can't sit in a folding chair next to a car at a car show for 10 minutes before I am bored stupid. Yeah. I have to get up, walk around, talk to people, look at cars, learn something. I applaud people who want to do it because it's also an important part of sharing history and getting people excited, right? Mm-hmm. But the only ones that I do religiously, we have events called Concours of Lemons where we celebrate the odd and the insane. And I've taken the Toyota Century to a couple of those. Matter of fact, I won the Japanese class in it in Monterey during Monterey Car Week in 2018.
Yeah.
So that was fun. But again, what I did all day with the car was I had all the doors open and I had all the weird gizmos working. And I invited every single person, especially if they were a kid, to come and climb around in the car and enjoy it and understand it, not stand 5 feet behind a rope and say, oh, well, we can't touch that thing. I think that you just got to let people get involved with your car if you want them to love it.
So you come across as a driver and not someone who shrink wraps their car for winter.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There's an old joke. I'm where, you know, potentially where cars go to die. That's not good. I'm trying to work, make sure I don't keep that reputation, but,
So I want to buy something probably later on this year that's going to hopefully appreciate in value, but I can drive as a ongoing project and add bits to. What kind of car? I've got a car in mind that I'm thinking of. What do you suggest? What kind of flavor?
Well, I have done a lot of seminars lately on what's hot in the market and what should you buy. And while there's no crystal ball, we can certainly show trends, right? And if I was going to buy a car, I would look at like a Porsche 914 if you wanted something vintage, because I think there's a lot of room to go in Porsche 914s. And also stuff, even staying with Porsche, look, you like 944s? 944 Porsches are on a rise like crazy, and they are so drivable. There are a lot of them out there. You can track them. If you find a nice original one, they're now accepted to go to most shows because of the age. These are, you know, arguably 80s cars. They're all over 25 years old now.
Yeah.
And they're incredible to drive. I honestly, I would, if you want a vintage thing that's rising, we just did a seminar with the Porsche Club here in America. Yes. 914s are hot. And 944s are also really, really good. And there's a lot of variety there.
I prefer 914 because they're rarer in the UK. I had a 924 Le Mans edition.
Neat.
So it wasn't, so there's apparently this, I've done a little bit of research on this. There's two Le Mans cars out there. There's the wide bodied one, which is the turbo 924. And then they made the just the normally aspirated 924 Le Mans. And all that had was the stripes down the side. It said Le Mans down it. They made them in certain colors and they stiffened up the suspension. No, not much more power than the original car. Had a wing on the back and stuff. And I bought one in 2016. It had low mileage on it. Well, I thought it had low mileage, but I think it went around the clock because those clocks don't have, they only have certain number of digits.
Sure.
So if they go around the clock, they actually start at zero again, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas most new cars now, they don't do that, do they? I mean, but so I bought it for a certain value and I sold it for exactly the same value in about 3 years, after 3 years. And somebody said to me last week, you shouldn't have sold that car for less than £15,000. And I was like, but I had it advertised for about 6 months all over the internet. And the best I got was, you know, £3,000-£4,000 at best. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yeah, it's a collectible. Yeah, there was less than, I think, 1,000 made of them worldwide. But if people aren't going to pay the money, what do? You can't, you know what I mean? So it was a little bit of an eye-opening moment for me because when I first bought that car, I got so excited that I bought a rare Porsche. And then one of my friends who drives a 911 said to me, it's not really a Porsche, it's a Volkswagen. And I thought...
People are over that now, honestly. I don't think people worry about that. You know, a 914 not being accepted as a true Porsche, I believe those days are over, honestly.
Yeah, because the 914s are getting really rare over here. I think you'll probably pick one up for about £8,000 here now, which is about, what's that, about $10,500, $11,000, I'd say.
Yeah, that's about right. And, you know, in really nice ones and really nice condition, obviously they go up.
So I mean Porsche is where I'm at really. Porsche, I was thinking a 356, but they're serious money now.
A lot of money.
A guy that I know in the UK just bought one for £55,000, but it's a complete wreck.
Yeah.
I don't know, I haven't got a clue what he can save on it, you know. There are workshops that make panels for those cars in the UK.
Right.
But that's serious money as well. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So we'll see. We'll see what happens, I guess.
Well, you know, another, if you like those transaxle cars, the 924s and 944s, I think a hot one that's going to go up a lot personally. So you look at the last year of the 924, and I guess they called it the 924S, I think. But all I know is it's the last year 924 was really a narrow body 944, if you think about it, because it had the 944 driveline, the narrow body, the suspension, all that stuff. So they actually performed really, really well. I think they were a little quicker even than the 944 when it first came out. So that's kind of a neat ticket in 924, is get that very last year when it had all the 944 good stuff underneath it. So I kind of like that. I think that's going to be pretty collectible. People start to differentiate little tiny model lines, but in the greater one. That'd be fun, I think.
I did see one on eBay recently. It was going for £1,300. £1,300.
Mm-hmm.
That's nothing, is it? That's like, what's that, $1,700? Dollars or $2,000? I mean, it's bound to go up, isn't it? Surely.
Yes, I believe so. You know, and again, the devil's in the details on these things. So a cheap on the front end, does it mean it's just going to bury you alive as you work through the project? You've got to be really educated on what you're buying. And I'm no expert. I mean, I've certainly thought that I knew what I was looking at and then found, you know, I had a TR3 that I loved. I adored that car. And I started to strip the paint off it. And the body had been basically made of like bent road signs that had been welded into panels. It was turned out to be just abysmal.
I was going to ask you about that. You've got TR3 in the background. Is that that's your car, is it?
No, that's just a picture, an old historic, thing, but I'm a British car nut. I mean, I like a little of everything, but yeah. I've had two TR3s. I've had two Sunbeams. Mm-hmm. I had an E-Type. I had a 70 fixed head coupe that was gorgeous. A few others. So I love British cars, and I have a hard time believing that there's a more pure motoring experience than a vintage British car that you can scrape your hand along the ground as you drive, like a TR3. I just think there's nothing cooler.
Yeah, I actually built an electric junior TR3 for my son.
Neat.
Yeah, which I showed at the Concourse of Elegance at Hampton Court Palace this year. I entered into the junior concourse for that. I got embarrassed when I turned up, though, because it wasn't finished. So I did explain to them that it wasn't finished before I brought it there, and they said, it's fine, just bring it. And then when I got there, the lady said to me, that the concourse judge, she said, are you going to be all right driving it around the concourse, you know, to show people? And I said to her, whoa, the electric motor is not connected, so it's not a good idea for me to do that. Otherwise, I'm going to be pushing it around. She went, that's fine, just push it around. So if you go on YouTube, you'll see me pushing around my son in this electric TR3, this green thing. But this project started out with me. I wanted to buy my son a pedal car because I think it's important to get kids into classic cars pretty early on.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, what can I get him? And I was going to get an Austin J40 pedal car. And there's thousands of them out there. So I thought, no. Let's go for something rare because I like rare stuff. So I looked around and I spoke to a guy at work who runs the J40 pedal club. And he said to me, why don't you go for a Triumph TR3? And I said, well, I can't find one. I was looking around and I couldn't find one. So he said, no, he said, the gentleman that designed them for Triumph is still alive. He's in his 80s. Here's his number. So I rang up the number and I said to the guy, can I speak to so-and-so? And he went to me and I said, he's asleep at the moment. I said, okay. it was an old people's home. It was a home where they go to rest and recuperate. So I said, okay, what time can I call? And he told me a specific time. He said, between 11 and 12 tomorrow or between 3 and 5. Other than that, he's either eating or sleeping. So I said, fine, fair enough. So I rang back and I spoke to this guy and he only made 100 of these TR3 junior pedal cars. So now I'm onto a good story here. So I'm thinking, what can I do? So I asked him where I could get an original mold. And he told me there's a guy in Coventry in north of England who can, in the Midlands, that can provide you with, he's got the original mold to make the TR3 bodies. I said, fine, that's fabulous. So I went there, bought that, and then I started to get all the bits and pieces. And now I'm at the point where I need the bright work done. But getting the bright work done on a car that's half scale is pretty difficult, you know, because I'm an engineer, so I understand. So you've either got to design your own mold and then get someone to mold it, to pour metal into it, or you can 3D print it, for example. That's another option, but then you've got to find an original badge or bonnet badge or handle to scan, 3D scan, reverse engineer it, 3D print it, and then get it chromed. So there's all these things are going through my head at the moment. So, but this September is the Concourse of Elegance again. I think they're doing it at Windsor Castle this time. Okay. Her Majesty's residence. So I'm hoping to be entered again, and hopefully this time I would have finished it, and hopefully win the competition, because I was beaten by a Porsche 917, which was absolutely spot on, beautiful.
Wow.
Beautiful. If you go on YouTube, have a look, just say Junior Concourse of Elegance and it will come up. You'll see us all going round. But it was a really nice day out. You know, we all got glammed up, you know, we all got our suits, and my wife had a nice dress on, and, you know, my son enjoyed it. He was only three at the time, you know, he was sitting in the car. He was wondering, all these little ones around him in cars, you know, you had Aston Martin DB5s, Ferrari, Maserati junior cars, all going around the concourse. People were cheering, and it was such a nice day, you know. So hopefully I'll do it again this year, but this time I'll have it finished. Restorations, right? So when we talk about restorations, how do you make the decision to either go full on nut and bolt restoration, or just kind of a little restoration, and just keep the history of the car? There's a fine line there, isn't there?
Yeah, there can be. I think you have to really think about what the purpose of the car is going to be. Yeah. So with my Sunbeam, the Tiger, I wanted to focus very much on heavy mechanical reliability, fun of the driving factor, and keeping that period look. So all that stuff was important to me. I wasn't that, like, if you jacked my car up, put it up on a lift and looked underneath it, a Concours person would be horrified, because it's got undercoating on it from probably 1971. Yeah. It's covered in oil and grease and dirt from driving and driving and driving. But I don't look at that. That's a rust preventative for me. It's to know that there's a little oil sweeping along under there. So that's kind of the thing. I think you just have to be realistic. I've seen so many people say, oh, I can't drive that car, I just restored it. Or, you know, it's too nice to drive. I'm like, well, why did you do that? Like, you know, are you going to put it in a museum now and never? I mean, there are certain types of cars that, yes, they're so rare. It's one of maybe three left in the world, blah, blah, blah. Sure, fine. Okay, preserve that for the enjoyment of the hobby. Maybe you build a replica. Hey, at Goodwood, we know that there are real GTOs, and then there are sometimes exact clones of GTOs that are out there on the track, because maybe the other doesn't want to take $80 million and hurl it into a corner next to some guy in a TR3, right?
Yeah. Of course.
So I get the differences there, but me personally, my version of a nut and bolt is, I don't know if I'd ever do it. Like, I like taking things apart and making them mechanically sound and reasonably nice looking to drive, drive. That's my whole thing.
Yeah, there's a company in the UK called DK Engineering. They make replica 250 GTO Ferraris. You've seen them?
Yep, absolutely.
Apparently, they get original parts from Ferrari, and their prices are about, I think, £250,000 upwards.
Yeah, I know those folks, and you know, you think of when they first started making those cars. What you would do, you'd go get a 330, you know, or a 250 GTE or something that wasn't viewed as really even collectible. You'd yank the V12 and the transmission out of it, and then that would become the heart of your project. So it was an authentic GTO. Well, now those quote unquote donor cars, they're out there. Those people are now restoring those cars. They're worth $500,000 and they want their original engine back. Everybody's out there looking for, okay, I've got my, I know that my GTE should have engine number X, and there are people that are trying to match engines that went into replicas with the original car and putting them together again. So
really,
because
there have been engines go missing as well, hasn't there? Especially like Lamborghini. Was it Lamborghini Miura? Do you know the Miura, the very first one of production? Have they actually found that yet? Or they did find it recently?
I can't say for sure on the very first one, but you know, you think about what, you know, you're an engineer, you think about what manufacturers were doing. Prototypes, they're just trying to build a car that they can go sell to make money to make more cars, or in Ferrari's case, go racing. I mean, We take this huge look now at historic racing provenance and, oh, well, this car it raced in period is this. And why did they, where's the motor that was in it? It's like, well, it wasn't, it didn't matter to the class the thing was racing in the next year, right? They could sell it or it got scrapped or whatever, because it didn't matter at the time. It was all about, you know, evolution and progress.
Yeah.
And so there's just, it's not like nobody hated history. It just, it wasn't history at the time. You know, you got to understand the, you know, kind of why people, what the mindset of the period was, you know?
Yeah. Fair enough. So five car garage, unlimited value. What would you choose?
Oh man. All right. Put me on the spot on that one. First one's got to be a 289 Cobra. Call it a 65, an original Shelby. They are the ultimate, I think, you know, Americanized incredible thing, right? You take it, take that ace, that original beautiful AC body. Shelby did his work. 289 Cobra. I prefer the small block ones more than the big blocks. I just think they look more right. I like that. I know that they are uncomfortable to drive and they are polarizing, but you got to give me an early Lamborghini Countach. They're just, there's just too much of everything a car has ever been or ever will be in like an LP400, you know, Countach like that before they got so crazy festooned, like, you know, you keep the wing off it, keep those flares off. Just give me that original design Lamborghini Countach.
Okay.
Absolutely love it.
Yeah.
I'd probably have to say a 67 911S because it's the most pure interpretation of that original 911.
Yeah.
There were so many just special things about the 67, those little 4.5-inch wide wheels. They're you can pick one up with your finger. They're so light. The purity of that, I really, really love. Do you mind if I pick a race car for number four?
Yeah, go for it. Yeah, unlimited.
Yeah, I have to say a 917 would be something that I would want tucked in the back. So iconic. And I could probably go 952, but give me the original. I've been to a lot of events where you see those hurtling down the track. You know, some of the Ren Sports and Monterey Historics and things like that. And it's just really nothing like a 917. They're just too epically cool.
Yeah.
The last one, the last car.
Yeah.
This is going to be a little weird, but I'd kind of like my first 65 Mustang back.
Yeah.
But you'd have to do something kind of magical with it, which is maybe why it's on the list, because 6 months after, I had it, I totaled it.
Oh, so, no.
Yeah. So I'm always trying to kind of relive and rewind a little bit back, because I've become such a preservationist and a car lover over the years and years. And that one just still really irks me that I had this great car. And it was worth $3,500 in the 80s. Okay. It wasn't that collectible then. But in the rearview mirror, I'm like, God, I wish I still had that one. That would have been really cool to still have.
Yeah. Okay. Road trip. Where, who, with, and what car?
Man, see, road trips are my thing. I plan a lot of rallies for Hagerty, and I've been able to do a lot of them in all my time speed racing stuff. There's a couple. One of them isn't too far from you. There's like a 500-mile road up from around Scotland, right? That is supposed to be one of the most incredible driving places that you can do. I've got to do that. I would really, really love to do that one there.
That's on my list of places to go actually this year. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Who is in what car?
I think it's got to be pure British motoring. I think it's got to be in something like a TR3 just to get the most wind in your face. And if you get a little spritzed on by the salt coming around, I think that's going to be, that would be okay. And if I had to pick a co-driver, I'm going to have to use a time machine for who I would want, because there, I've talked about this before. I think Sir Malcolm Campbell would have been the most fascinating person to spend time with, that you could ever do. What a pioneer. What a person that, I mean, everything he did was absolutely death defying. To spend time in a car with him would be really, really cool. So that would be neat. So we'll do 500 miles around Scotland in a British car, a little TR3, and I'll have Sir Malcolm Campbell with me. How about
that's
that?
That's good. Last question before I let you go. Reviving a bankrupt or forgotten car brand, which one would you bring back?
Ooh, boy. I kind of think Sunbeam is a really good, and I've seen prototypes of Tigers that have maybe been revamped.
Yeah.
Sunbeam had a hard time because the brand, you know, under Roots Group was bought by, you know, Chrysler Corporation back in the mid 60s. Mm-hmm. And it went away. Like, you couldn't have Tigers anymore because Chrysler wasn't going to warranty a car that had a Ford engine in it. It just wasn't going to work. It all went away. I think that would be pretty neat. But you know, there are a lot of manufacturers that have gone by the wayside. Pontiac in the United States, I was very surprised with a brand with that much history that went away. A lot of the big names, I'm still happy. You know, you look at Porsche and Ferrari and Lamborghini and things like that. I think they're all, I'm thrilled they're all still out there. You know, but I would say I'd personally like to see Sunbeam come back. I think that'd be pretty cool.
Good choice. Well, listen, Brad, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. I would love to do this again. I would love to meet you face to face, and I'd love to come over to the States. And if you want to go on that 500 mile drive around Scotland, then yeah, just give me a shout. I'm sure you've got loads of people in the UK that would want to go with you. But it's been a pleasure, man. Honestly, meeting you, talking to you, getting into your knowledge, and you know, you're a clever guy with classic cars, and appreciate your time. Okay,
it's been great. Thanks for having me on, and you and I shall see each other in the real world.
I hope so. But just tell us where to find you. Where can people find you?
Well, I'm always on Hagerty.com on our media site. If you go to Hagerty's Facebook page and look at videos, you'll see interviews and things that I've done over the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. You can go to I've written a lot of articles and done things also that are on our media sites. You can search for that. So, you know, just, you can Google Brad Phillips Hagerty articles and, you know, you'll find me there and make a connection. It's great.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Well, thanks very much for your time, Brad. Have a nice day. All right.
Absolutely. Thanks again.
Thanks, everyone. Take care. Bye-bye.